So right, your apprenticeship comes to an end then, Clive, after 5 years, and you stayed on at the company, I understand. And where did you work in those next few years before you left?
Well, just we were building presses. I finished in 83. Yeah, it was some of the bigger ones would be we did some grinding mill presses, we did DDI presses, forging presses, so and primarily extrusion and concrete. But I found the forging presses and the and we did some continuous casting machinery, which I was always willing and quite keen to go to site and install equipment. So I went to the British Steel Ravenscraig and Folk's Forge and places like that, and to see the steel making process in action, continuous casting was wonderful sight to see. See 150 tons of molten steel poured and rolled through the ingot and down through the rollers, and to see a 2,000 ton forge with a 25 ton red hot ingot underneath it as a basically a 25 ton lump of metal, but then hours later it would be a 25 foot long propeller, ship's propeller, and the control of the guys operating the forge, because it wasn't just a forge, it was a crane, it was a manipulator to deal with the holding the length of metal in red hot condition and turning it so the manipulator could produce the right dimensions and flats and squares and diamonds. Wonderful sight. So to see those things where big machinery is exerting great power, it's I find it very fascinating.
Was that still working out of the pipe shop, or did you have a
Yes, yeah, so I was in the pipe. I did work in the fitting shop as well, but generally there was my work was piping, and I quite enjoyed it. It was quite artistic. If you had a big project to do, you could. Everybody's would be different, you know.
So eventually, then you left the company. That was 1983, I think you said, and returned again in 94.
That's right.
So, when you came back, was it an answer to an advertisement, or did you apply for a job? Can you remember?
What happened? I think I know Roger Beard is involved. I think he might have rung me up. I can't remember, John. I should do, but I'm not. Not completely familiar, but anyway, I know I spoke to Roger, and he said, "Oh, are you interested in doing work?" Because I'd left in 1983, and I went to work for Doughty Fuel Systems, and I worked in their test facilities department, building test rigs for Tornado and Pegasus, you know, for the RB, for the RB199 for the Tornado and Pegasus for the Harrier, and the test rigs were basically a fairly an installation of piping and valves inside a frame, and to field in a Platt standard, it was quite comfortable, easy work. And I must admit, the work ethic in Doughty's, given that it was a big company that relied on ministry contracts, it was fairly relaxed. And within 18 months of being there, the foreman left, so I applied for the job and got made foreman. So that was so I went into the supervisory role, and then Doughty's at that stage was becoming the work was being reduced in all parts of Doughty, and they closed the fuel systems. So I went to another department, which was building pure air generators for thermal imaging, and these generators you could build one in 2 days. Well, I've been used to things that took 3 months, and the individual was part of the machine, where these were just, you know, a production line. So I left, and then I worked for Hitachi Zosen Clearing, which was a press manufacturer for stamping presses, and Field and Platt had built clearing presses in its time, so I was familiar with that. So I worked for them, and then I finished there in 2004, and then I started back at Fieldings as installation manager.
Oh, that was the next question. What was your position, and what responsibilities do you have then, Clive?
Well, we at that stage there was the new equipment. What were we building? There were some equipment, because at that stage Fielden and Platt encompassed John Shaw, Henry Berry, Chester Hydraulics. So we did core building machines for Henry Berry, for the car industry, a lot of them for Ford. We built presses for the aerospace industry for John Shaw's in Chester. And Fielden and Platt's equipment itself, I know we did a press for Royal Ordnance Summerfield in Kidderminster, which was a rocket propellant press, which, because of the current situation, there was not that much work. So I remember speaking to Norm and saying, well, if rather than paying somebody to put all the piping on, I'll do it myself. So I volunteered and designed it and built it, and that press went, and I installed it in Royal Ordnance Summerfield, and that was a good job.
Did you travel abroad much, Clive?
Yes, yeah, not so much at that time, but I was just looking at my map, and I first went abroad as a 20-year-old. I had a call from, I think it must have been Bob Phelps or somebody, I think they wanted, we were building at that time, car bumper bar machinery that came from Redman in Worcester. And we sent several presses to mainly European customers. One of them was Raufoss in Norway. So we'd sent them a piece of equipment, and there was some piping that was quite inaccessible, and I think it wasn't properly prepared, basically. So they wanted it replaced. And they said, do you want to go to Norway? So I said, OK. And I remember I was 20 years old, and I went down to Heathrow, never flown before, so I caught the plane to Heathrow to Frankfurt. And I got met in Frankfurt by, I think, Edgar Zakharovsky. That's right, Edgar Zakharovsky, a Redman guy. And I believe he was Russian, Edgar. But he'd worked for the Redmans, and there was a lot of machinery had been sold from Redmond to Togliatti in Russia. So I think he might have come through that connection. Anyway, I flew out to Frankfurt and went to Edgar's home. And I think around about, we had dinner and sat down and talked, and then Edgar said, right, that's it. And I thought, maybe that's the end of the evening. So we went to the car, and then we started off from Rüsselsheim, which was around about Frankfurt area, and drove non-stop 1,000 miles on a Friday night through Germany, and caught the ferry across to Denmark. Whilst in Denmark, obviously, Edgar was doing the driving and he got a bit tired. So he said to me, do you drive, Clive? I said, well, I can drive. Well, so next thing I know, I'm behind the left-hand drive of the Volkswagen, rather, negotiating the roads in Denmark. Anyway, we crossed the from Helsingborg to Helsingborg, whatever it is, and then he did all the city work, and then I think somewhere in Sweden he asked me again, so I drove into Sweden, and then we arrived in Raufoss, beautiful Raufoss, on a spring morning, snow in the village, and it was for my first trip overseas, I obviously wouldn't forget that in a hurry. And what was funny, actually, was in the car, Edgar, if you're driving 1,000 miles, there must be incidents that cause alarm or cause you to get a bit concerned with other drivers. And Edgar would use some ripe language, but I believe his wife was German, so she didn't understand it, but obviously I did. It was quite funny. But it was and then we did the work in about 10 days, and I ended up flying home from Norway back to London. So that was an interesting start to my overseas work. Whilst at Fieldings, I also did a big project in Egypt. There was Roger Beard had sold a new stretching machine to the Aluminium Company of Egypt. And whilst there, obviously, super salesman Roger saw that they were producing billets and other aluminium equipment. So do you want to buy a press? And rather than sell your billets, why don't you extrude them? So he talked the Aluminium Company of Egypt into buying this equipment. And it's a very, very big company. There's pot lines, huge. It's like the size of a small village, these sites, just mass. And what they do is basically bauxite, alumina, and getting power from the Aswan High Dam produce aluminium, and labour is not inexpensive. So they're a very long-established company. So I went to witness, to get involved in the disassembly at a late stage, and then I went out in September to Nag Hammadi, which is halfway between Cairo and Luxor, where the ancient historical monuments are. And I arrived in Egypt, and they said, right, there's where the equipment's going, and it was just a field of sand. There's nothing, there's no building, just a few posts in the ground. So, okay. Then we went to look at the equipment, which was in a properly prepared, hard-standing area, and the equipment was scattered alongside beautifully boxed items of new equipment. But ours looked like a scrapyard by comparison. And to such an extent that I found the main cylinder, a main cylinder of a 2,000-ton press, I don't know, maybe 50 tons, something like that. But it was upside down. I said, this is upside down. And how did this happen? Oh, no, this is how we received it. And they denied it, but in the end, after several... we did some investigation of the equipment itself, and you could see damage and where it had picked up debris from the road. They said, oh, actually, it fell off the truck coming away from Alexandria. So anyway, that project started in 1996, and the project was completed in 1998, 2 years. But it wasn't just the press. It was the handling gear. It was the aging ovens. It was all of the equipment and a complete handling system. And in the end... George Claridge came out to finish the project with me, but very interesting.
Does thinking about Egypt and all that, was there any problems with security or anything, Clive?
No. When I was... Oh, that, yes, there would have been, sorry. Yeah, 96. There was one occasion, I think it was towards the end anyway, probably 98 maybe, yeah, that would be right. There was one of the... they did attack on the Hatshepsut temple, where a group of Japanese and Swiss tourists were attacked. And I wasn't there at the time, but I returned shortly afterwards. And from the time before I left to the time I went back, everything had changed. By, if there was 100 people before, it was 10. It must have, the tourism industry must have, you know, had a 90% reduction. And that was really the start of problems that, you know, have continued, unfortunately, ever since.
Obviously you've travelled a lot and all that, Clive, and seen the world a lot. Was there any particular achievement that you treasure the most?
One of them ones, I did a big project for Airbus 380. Press was ordered by Airbus because of the fuselage of the 380 was bigger than anything that had been built before, and the stretch formers weren't capable of holding these big sections. So Airbus Industries in Europe used the supplier of their existing machinery, which was Hufford in Los Angeles. So they ordered a new machine piece of equipment, which was twice the size of anything they had as an existing piece of equipment. And the Hufford company had then been sold to Erie Press. And we built some work for Erie Press at Field in a Platt in our time, I remember that. But the people from Hufford in Los Angeles didn't want to go to cold, dreary Erie, Pennsylvania. The winter's about 9 months long there, and it's pretty pretty grey and not so pleasant in their eyes, I suppose, to Los Angeles. So Erie had the press, but they decided to build it in Italy, and they used Mecfond, which was a mechanical press supplier. As I'd worked in the mechanical press industry, I'd heard of Mecfond. So I went out there to insist and advise on the hydraulic system, because they'd built the press, and they had a big machine shop with 100-ton boring facilities, welding facilities. But the press was standing, but there was no hydraulic system on it. and the number of people in the Mekfon company were greatly reduced. They had nobody with experience to do it, and nobody at Hufford or LNF Industries, which had been bought by Erie Press, was prepared to travel to Erie in Pennsylvania, so they couldn't answer any questions on it. So I went out, and somebody had been to look at it and said it was 3 weeks' work. Well, when I went to see it, I said, this is 3 months' work, not 3 weeks. Anyway, I got a hold of it, and Airbus needed this machinery for the 380. Very, very important. I mean, you can't build anything without a fuselage. And Mekfon had told Airbus that the machine was finished and they were going to start testing in 2 weeks' time. So they basically hid the truth from Airbus, and Airbus decided to come and have a look at it. And they came and had a look at it when I was there. And you know, obviously you can imagine what happened. There was all hell let loose. And at least at that stage I said, well, I've started, but I've only started 2 weeks ago. And they could see 2 weeks' work was sort of existing. And how long is it going to take? I said, well, it's going to take a month, 6 weeks. They said, well, we'll come back in a month. And they came back in a month. And at that stage, I was getting assistance, but not the best. So I said, the best thing we can do to Airbus is take it out of here immediately, and we'll take it to Germany where it's been installed, and I'll finish it there, which I did. But to finish that machine, it was quite a complex machine because it was stretched and there was great movement in it. And it was something that I started with a blank piece of paper. I had no drawings. I had one circuit diagram and a foundation drawing. The foundation drawing was completely wrong. So I had one piece of paper and I finished it off, and Airbus were very pleased, very grateful. But it was an interesting job. And for me to do a proper piping job and design it all myself and bend it all, and so Ken Juggins' experience, Reg Gregory, Les George, all these, Brian Boucher, all the people I've worked with, all of their experience, and just having worked with them, and to be able to go there and survive on your own and get it's, site work and is respect. And if you get people's respect and they respect you, anything is possible. So we finished it off.
A wonderful experience. Well, thanks for that, Clive.